So court cases, especially someone else's court cases, can feel pretty removed from our everyday lives. But right now, there is a court case playing out in Boston that could really affect the power of mayors, cities in the Commonwealth to affect police reform. Then there's also one in Rhode Island that the Supreme Court just took on about guns. Plus, the court's ready to consider a case on abortion. These are core issues. They matter for our lives, and they are the political hot points of the day. Fortunately, we know Nancy Gertner, who is a retired federal judge and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, also WBUR's legal analyst, and she is here to tell us what we need to know about these cases and how they could affect us. Judge Gertner, welcome back.
Okay, good to be back.
All right, so let's start with the policing case in Boston. So just for our listeners as a review, we've covered it on the show. Acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey tried, basically, to fire suspended police commissioner Dennis White. White had been appointed by Boston Mayor Marty Walsh and then almost immediately suspended over prior domestic violence allegations. An investigation ensued, and then last week, Acting Mayor Janey tried to dismiss him as a result of that investigation. White sued immediately in an effort to keep his job. Walk us through what the argument is and why it matters on an even bigger stage than Boston.
Well, the mayor has a right to appoint a police commissioner. And a police commissioner job is different than a patrolman job. In other words, the patrolman, you're talking about the right to be on the police force at all. But the commissioner is already a police officer, and so the question is, is there some kind of right, you know, to remain in this elevated position? There is an old statute that says that after a commissioner has been appointed by the mayor, he can only be removed on notice and a showing of cause. It doesn't define what notice and showing of cause would be. So the question is whether or not the rights of a police commissioner to that job are the same kind of rights that a patrolman might have to his job, where there's with a patrolman, to kick a cop off the force requires a pretty hefty showing, an arbitration, a showing of cause, a careful appeals, et cetera. There's nothing like that with the police commissioner, and there's an argument that that wouldn't make sense. You're not talking about the same set of rights. White is asking for an injunction that would restore him into the position while the case is being litigated. The case about what kind of notice he should have had is being litigated. And that would be an extraordinary precedent. If a court said, well, you know, the procedures were bad here, and therefore the highest cop in the city should remain on the job. It's so unlikely that a court would do that. So unlikely that a court would restore White to this position, given the fact that this really is a different position than an ordinary police officer. What's more than likely is that he will lose emergency relief, and who knows whether his claims will then go away. But the issue here is a commissioner is just a very different kind of position than a cop who has substantial rights to being a cop.
And this would affect, then, how a city or town could deal with an accountability issue with its essentially top police officer.
Right, because if a judge grants a preliminary injunction in this situation, then an officer whose background has been challenged in the way that White's background would be challenged would be on the job in the highest position in the Boston police hierarchy, and that would be an extraordinary outcome. What I'm trying to communicate is that a police commissioner is, you know, sort of a cop plus, and that therefore the notion that the mayor doesn't have the right to make the decisions that Janey made that in a much more summary fashion than she would with respect to a police officer doesn't make any sense.
All right. And listeners know we are going to continue to watch that case and report on it, both at WBUR and here on Radio Boston. All right. So let's go from police in Boston to guns in Rhode Island. And actually, this case wound up at the U.S. Supreme Court. They ruled on a case involving a man in Cranston, Rhode Island. Edward Coniglia, who back in 2015 had a fight with his wife, pulled out a loaded gun, told her to shoot him. The next day, his wife called the police and Coniglia was taken to the hospital for psychiatric evaluation. While that was happening, the police seized two guns from his home. Now, they were eventually returned, but he sued, saying that the police violated his Fourth Amendment rights. How did the court rule, and why are these issues important for us?
Well, this was very interesting. This was a unanimous court that ruled that the police were wrong to enter Coniglia's home to seize the guns. It was very interesting because they were unanimous. And why were they unanimous? Because essentially the originalists on the court believe that when the Fourth Amendment says you have a right to be free in your homes, they mean that. They mean homes, and homes were sort of the irreducible minimum of the Fourth Amendment, that the British soldiers could not knock down the door to your homes. The liberals on the court, of course, also believe that, but in addition believe that individuals have privacy rights. What's stunning to me is that our Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals for Massachusetts, had a unanimous decision in the opposite direction, which says something interesting. So it suggests that rules with respect to the extent to which police have a right to cross your threshold, your home threshold, remain in place, notwithstanding the changes in the Supreme Court. A car is a different matter.
All right, so the district court judge, John J. McConnell Jr., you said, went in the other direction. There was what was invoked there is an idea called community caretaking, which says that essentially police can have a legitimate safety concern that would cause them to take away a gun, a firearm. If the Supreme Court was unanimous in another direction, does that raise larger issues for whether community caretaking exceptions can happen in states?
I think it doesn't raise larger issues. I think it keeps standing the rules about the seizure of cars. So the case that originated the community caretaking exception was a car that had been disabled after an accident, left on the street, and the argument was the cops had to do something for that car with respect to that car, had to make sure that it wasn't a public safety threat, and so they searched the car. A home is obviously a different matter, and so this really reinforces the view, candidly, one's home is one's castle. Caretaking may apply to mobile vehicles, but doesn't apply to a home.
All right, so let's talk about another one. We're going to stay with the Supreme Court for the rest of this segment. There's one that could be of interest to every school and every teen, probably the most high-profile case or one of them. Brandy Levy, a 14-year-old cheerleader who was suspended from her cheerleading team for the year after she posted some harsh language about the school on social media, raised questions about what constitutes school speech, which is a designation that allows schools to regulate off-campus speech that is disruptive to the school community. Seems like there could be a lot at stake for every school district with this one. What do you make of the case?
Well, this is very interesting because in a social media infused world, if schools are going to be policing or regulating off-campus speech that is on social media by teenagers, I'm not sure they'll have time to do anything else. And in fact, the gist of the argument in this case, if to the extent that an oral argument reflects what the court is going to do, was exactly on both sides, conservative and liberal side, how are you going to police this? What are the limits here? What's the difference? It was not that she, it would have been one thing if she said, if the cheerleader said something that was a threat and that forecast actions in the school, but this was letting off steam. And as the mother of two sons, now much older, oh my! they would be doing not much of anything else. So I mean, I would actually predict that this speech, however, you know, horrifying of the cheerleader who was annoyed that she didn't get on the squad, is likely to be protected and not within the purview of what schools will be dealing with. Again, there's a difference between threatening speech. And even as to that, the threat has to be imminent. There are rules with respect to when threatening speech can be actionable. But this really was letting off steam, and, you know, that happens.
All right. So when will they likely rule on this? Next year?
I imagine that this would be part of the rulings that would come down. Well, it's hard to know. It would either be June or in the fall. It's hard to It's hard to know exactly. But as I said, people talk about the changes in the court, and there really are substantial changes in the court. But there are areas in which the judges all aligned, and I think this will be one, just as the Coniglia case in Rhode Island was another.
Okay, but the news from SCOTUS this week, probably one where they won't come down on the same side. The court announced it's going to hear a case involving Mississippi's abortion law, which bans most abortions after 15 weeks. Seems like the whole country is watching this one. What do you make of it and the court's decision to take it on?
Well, this is the case that is the bellwether case that shows the difference between only last year when Justice Ginsburg was on the court and today. The court last year had thrown out a Louisiana statute that required doctors that abortions be performed in hospitals and found that it was an undue burden. This was a court it was a 6-3 decision. And now they have agreed to take on a case that is a body blow to Roe v. Wade, because the Mississippi statute prohibits abortions pre-viability. So it is essentially second trimester abortions, which under Roe, the state can only regulate if the mother's health is involved. This is saying it doesn't matter whether the mother's health is involved. The statute is saying you may not have abortions after after 20 weeks. And so that really is a body blow to Roe. The fact that they're taking it is troubling.
So we know that regardless how the court rules, folks in the Commonwealth, there are state-level abortion laws on the books here that protect that right. And yet this still feels of the moment and personal here in the Commonwealth. Why is that?
Well, we have actually constitutional protections under the state constitution and other states as well. Actually, in a case that I did when I was a child, the Supreme Judicial Court ruled that abortion was protected under the state constitution. And so this really wouldn't immediately affect us. The question is, the more sustained this assault on abortion rights is, the chance, there's at least a chance that the Supreme Court could speak in terms that would be so broad to offer protections for the fetus, for example, under the federal constitution, and that would wipe out state protections. So I don't think that they will do that. It's widely believed that this court will not overturn Roe v. Wade directly, that this court will simply limit it to a point where it matters very little. There's already been, restrictions from all across the country. So the odds are that's what's going to happen here, is that if they affirm a 20-week limit, a pre-viability limit, they will not be doing so in a way that directly overturns Roe v. Wade. In fact, that's what we've seen now in numbers of decisions with this court. The newest members of the court believe in precedent. All judges believe in precedent. That's how the system remains stable and legitimate. So what they're doing is, rather than reversing precedent, which they're not supposed to do, wholeheartedly, they are distinguishing these cases out of existence. They're coming up with all sorts of reasons why it doesn't apply here or there, prompting dissents from Kagan and Sotomayor, saying, call it for what it is. You're reversing this precedent. And so that's the troubling pattern of this.
And that is Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks. Appreciate the analysis.
Thank you.
Listeners, we're going to go to a break. When we come back, we will discuss how child well-being has been impacted by the pandemic. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.